Welcome to Counter Stories, our favorite time of the day, a program by people of color, for people of color, and everybody else. I'm Luz Maria Frias, Deputy Attorney General with the State of Minnesota. Any comments and opinions that I express are strictly my own and should not be attributed to my employer.
I'm Don Eubanks, Associate at Dendros Group and member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians.
And I'm Halili, owner of the Other Media Group and Counter Stories producer.
We don't have Anthony Galloway today, our regular crew member. He's unable to join us, but we have a fabulous guest, and I'm inviting our guest to introduce himself and say a little bit more about himself.
Well, great. Thanks for having me on the podcast today. I will do my best to fill some very, very big shoes. But my name is Huang Murphy, use he and pronouns, and I am the founder and executive director of a nonprofit based here in St. Paul named Foster Advocates. And just to say a little bit about our work, our Foster Advocates is our name, but it's also what we do. We foster advocacy by working with young people who have experienced foster care to create policy change. So some of those things that we do engage on are leadership programming for young people who have experienced care, but also big things like the Foster and Higher Education Act, which we passed last year, that gives anyone who experienced foster care ages 13 and up until age 27 in the state of Minnesota free access to any college in the state of Minnesota. That's two-year, one-year programs, tech programs, and all participating private schools as well.
Wow. That's phenomenal. Let's unpack that in just a little bit here, Huang. The one thing that I do want to highlight is May is Foster Care Awareness Month across our country. And so we want to make sure that folks are aware of that. And that is really the primary reason, as far as timing is concerned, that we have invited you. So Huang, you know, say a little bit more about yourself. I know the great work that you've been doing in community, given just the important issues with foster care. And we really want to go into some of the measures and successes that you've been able to, you and your team have been able to achieve. But I know that you have a particular passion and your background as a former English teacher, high school English teacher. So help us understand your journey into this role and into this field in particular, because it's a very specific field that I would venture to say not a whole lot of people know about, right? We've all heard foster care, loosely speaking, being referenced in society. But unless you are embedded in the system, and I speak from experience in terms of having friends who have navigated the foster care system and the trajectories and difficulties and barriers they've experienced personally. But before we go down any of those paths, really help us connect the dots in terms of your passion for this work and what brought you here.
Yeah. So starting off with super easy questions.
That's how we go. That's how we roll at Counter Stories, right?
I would be remiss to also not mention that it's AAPI Heritage Month as well. So I feel doubly honored as an Asian American and as a foster. I don't know if that's how it works, but I expect a double discount anytime I go somewhere. But it hasn't happened yet. But really, I got started in this work by accident. I didn't want to be the foster care guy. I didn't want to have my life be determined by by things I couldn't control, by things that happened to me. And so I quickly realized that I wasn't going to be able to be a social worker. That wasn't just not in the cards for me personally. But I knew I wanted to impact the system for young people. And so I went into ed policy work. So I went to Syracuse as part of my undergrad and studied public policy there. Was just, a small town kid. Ada is where I went to high school, but from Eastside St. Paul. And then when I entered CARE, then landed up there. And it was a major adjustment, but was able to go teach in Baltimore and then get my master's at Johns Hopkins in education and teaching there. And, really that's where I realized I was a social worker, just had a different title. Many of my young people had experienced foster care, and I knew exactly what they were going through. And how could I not use that knowledge to help them navigate that? I also knew then what needed to change. And so I left the classroom. I had to do something else. I want to say it's because I wanted to make a bigger impact, but I really don't think there's a bigger impact than teaching. But I just knew that I couldn't do that frontline work anymore. So, went to the U.S. Department of Ed, where I was able to be a public policy fellow in the last year of the Obama term, working for then Secretary King, and was able to, really just work on pushing out the regulations for the Every Student Succeeds Act. And then in the transition, came back to the state of Minnesota, really kind of newly engaged around this work. What you do when you're not sure what the future holds, you go back home. And home was this nebulous place that I didn't, that I survived but didn't really understand, which is our state. And realized that the things I experienced when I was in foster care, which I had hoped were uniquely bad, were actually pretty typical. The only thing unique about me is that I had made it, that I had been lucky enough to get through. Now that I was in a position to both understand how policy works, but also have this very real experience in care, I had to use that to make sure that, I'm not the only one that gets out. And so quit my job and founded this nonprofit, and it's been 3.5 years.
So Wong, I'm wondering if you can, and welcome to social work. I mean, regardless of what route we go, many of us end up in this area. But I think more importantly, I think that, I think often many of our listeners and many of us included, when we say foster care, there may be like certain things that come to people's minds. And I'm wondering, as you know, since you've started your own nonprofit, your agency in terms of advocacy, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about what actually falls under foster care. So people can understand. So I know that in your introduction, you mentioned that you were in foster care. Well, one item I've never mentioned in on Connor Stories is when I was younger, when I was 15, I was going through some stuff at home with my father, and I ended up in a group home. So, come to find out later that any removal from your home puts you in that category of foster care, even though I was in a group home. So I think it might help individuals understand, if you don't mind, if you could explain exactly everything that falls under that heading of foster care.
Yeah, I think that's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, welcome to the club. Really, any out-of-home placement is what we define as foster care. And so what we know in the, Indigenous community here in Minnesota is that means 1 in 4. So that means 1 in 4 Indigenous community members had to experience foster care and count as fosters. So I use the term foster. A lot of folks, I think nationally, will use things like foster alum. I'm just going to be real. I really, really hate that term. The reason is because think of the things that you're a alum of. You're an alum of, usually prestigious colleges. You're alum of programs. You're alum of things that you choose and have been chosen, that you're proud to be part of, and that you had, a lot of agency in doing so. Didn't choose to be incarcerated, didn't choose to experience trauma, didn't choose to be separated from our families. So foster alum doesn't quite fit, but foster, I think, captures the fact that you're in care. You're not always a young person or not always a youth, but, still a foster once you get older, because at least in, my early work when I was engaging with other fosters across the state, we had to find a way to define ourselves in our community. You can't organize unless you have a shared purpose and identity. And for us, it was this experience that was really unique in experiencing out-of-home placement. And so foster for us, I think foster care creates a really significant cultural identity akin to other immutable characteristics that goes unrecognized, once people age out or leave care, are adopted. And so responsibly use the term foster to name and claim that. But to answer your question more directly, foster care is that you were separated at some point from your family as a child by the state by government actors, not simply the state of Minnesota. So that can be an initiative tribe, that can be a county.
When we think about the impact, and you started down this by citing that 1 in 4 Indigenous youth are fostered, this is another reason why we thought this would be a compelling conversation for us, because fostering is disproportionately represented in our BIPOC communities, but also just in terms of the systemic reason for that, right? I see that you've been in public policy, which means you've been involved in systems change, and how important it is to look at the cause of these in terms of systems change and how they are betraying what should be happening, and that as a result ends up manifesting itself in these disparities.
Yeah, I mean, Minnesota often likes to talk about, you know, how exceptional it is and, you know, how amazing it is. Well, we are exceptional. We're the worst state in the country for separating Indigenous mm-hmm. communities and breaking up families. You are 25 times more likely to enter care as an Indigenous person in our state than if you are white. And that's a stark reality. That's the worst disparity of any state in the country. We should not get comfortable with that in any way, shape, or form. It is horrendous. We say the boarding school era ended. I'm not so sure. Based on what I'm hearing from our Native youth, this is not a thing that has been corrected for. It has been recognized and has been addressed. Maine has done truth and reconciliation around foster care and the boarding schools. Minnesota has done very little. For our African-American and Black peers, you're 3 times more likely to enter care. Now, 3 times doesn't sound so bad next to, 25, but 3 times more likely to enter care is still really, really awful. And there's some context I'd like to provide there, which is that the largest growing population who's experiencing foster care is 2 or more mixed race. Mm. What we know is about 50% or so are African-American, Black mixed with white, and the other half roughly are about Native American mixed white, which, is also a complexity on its own conversation. But that the numbers are probably a little bit higher. We don't do a great job of making sure that people understand what the racial identification is used for or why it's important. And as part of that, really what I'd like to address is that when we talk about disproportionality, we often talk about the overrepresentation in a system, but it also can mean the underrepresentation. This disproportionality in the opposite also says right. something, and it doesn't yep. necessarily say something good. We right. over-police Native and Black communities, but then we under-protect Native, Latin, and white communities, is what I would argue. There's a cost to that over-policing, and it's that these other communities then don't get the care that they deserve and the attention that they probably should.
You're listening to Counter Stories. I'm Luz Maria Frias with co-host Don Eubanks and Hilly Lee, and special guest Juan Murphy. This show is supported by AMPERS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com.
And I think about what I see in the community, my community at least, is something we really don't talk about, So if somebody, it's usually the situation where, an older person or grandparent is taking care of a grandchild because the parents, the state has deemed the parents inadequate to care for the child, but you don't talk about it as I'm fostering my grandkids because, their mother can't take care of them. It just becomes they're my grandkids and I take care of them. And nobody really questions it as far as that's foster care, right? The state says she can't have, that's foster care. It's just like, oh, that's what we do, right? It's our grandchild, so we're going to take care of it. But really, it's foster care. But we don't use that term. And so then when we hear foster care, or we hear that word foster, it comes with these bad connotations. But what we don't realize is it's actually happening in our community right now. And so there's this stigma around it, right? When you say foster, like if you're a kid who's coming out of foster, if you are a parent whose kids had to go into foster care when you get them back, or if you're the grandparent or you're the auntie or somebody taking care of a relative's child, that I guess is considered fostering if the state has deemed their parent not fit to care for them.
It's, you know, the Hmong community and the Anishinaabe community, there's a lot of similarities because grandparents, aunts, uncles, everyone else steps in and helps raises that child. Because often mom and dad are too busy, you know, putting food on the table, doing this, that, and the other. And so in the American Indian community, it's a cultural thing for that to happen.
Right.
Now, but to touch on, and this is the area where I'm sure Hoang works in terms of his advocacy, because, you know, in one of my previous positions, I was Commissioner of Health and Human Services for the Mille Lacs Band. So I had to deal with these issues daily. And now, the first time I was up there was in the 90s. And so while this was a cultural thing, what we were aware of is that the county was still providing support for those individuals. But what many of us became aware of is that there was a different rate the county paid for someone who was a relative and just providing that care. Or if you got a certificate or license, then you got a higher rate. So the argument at that time in the American Indian community is that we need to get our grandparents and our aunts and uncles certified and licensed so that they could get this higher rate. So that's what we did. But when I came back the second term, later in about 2009, one of the things that I had to do is I had to sign off on all these foster care certificates that band members had. And I was absolutely astounded by the number we had that I had to sign off on. So what had been the issue when I was up there in the 90s was trying to get our grandparents at higher rate. Now I'm signing like 200-300 certificates. Hoang touched on it. There's issues all over. And then in the American Indian community, you throw in, one of the things the American Indian community did to combat our children being removed and put in boarding schools. But beyond that, there are other stories in terms of our community suffering from the dominant culture in this drive to assimilate us. And one of the things that they did that's not talked about is that they just removed children from Indian families and gave them out for adoption to white families, often without the mothers even being told. And this happened clear up until the 70s. And I kid you not, there are so many Native children that were just removed from homes for no reason other than to just place them in white families.
There were reports of that happening down at the border, right? When we were, you know, when families were being separated at the border, there were reports.
Oh, you mean recently during?
Recently, yeah, during the quote unquote caravans.
But this was happening in the American Indian community on a wholesale level. And so that's why the tribes got together and created the Indian Child Welfare Act. And it was a way to try for the American Indian community to try to keep those kids connected with their culture. I mean, that was the driving force behind ICWA. Now,
so what was that then? What was that demand? That demand was that they would Indigenous kids would be placed with Indigenous families?
Not exactly. It was that if that child had a connection or was enrolled or eligible for enrollment, or a descendant of a tribe, that the tribe then had to be notified and could be in, and get involved with that case.
Okay.
Now, the hope was that by that the child would be kept in the community, but that's not always the case.
Right.
So I think people, I think that's one of the misconceptions about ICWA that at least I hear from members of the dominant culture when they're working so hard to try to adopt Indian children, is they think ICWA was created to prevent them from doing that. And that's not really what ICWA was created. It was created to try to ensure that that child doesn't lose connection with its heritage.
I would venture to guess that Huang has quite a bit of insight on this. And I would just add before inviting Huang to weigh in that the Indian Child Welfare Act, also known as ICWA, as Don has mentioned, was passed in 1978. So it's relatively new, if you will, compared to the historical displacement of our native youth. You're listening to Counter Stories. I'm Luz Maria Frias with co-host Don Eubanks and Halil Lee, and special guest Juan Murphy. This show is supported by AMPERS and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com. But Juan, what's coming up for you as you hear the concerns and points made by Don and Hli?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to cover. You know, I'll just address it kind of in reverse order, or in the order. Hli, you know, really what you're speaking to is what I often hear. When I first started this work, I actually got some pushback from elders because they were like, well, why would you want to bring out all these bad issues? We know what's been happening in our families. To not rock the boat, we don't talk about it. That neither protects children, nor does it combat racism either. Now, we don't particularly like the solution of foster care, which, trust me, every foster is going to agree with that. But there's also a lot of young people who have had to endure far too much who are left in their homes. And, you know, at least when we're talking about Ramsey County in Minnesota, which is where St. Paul is, or the fastest growing population in need of child protection are Asians. And that's largely driven by Southeast Asian community members. That means Hmong, Viet, Laotian, you know, really just that like group of refugees that came to this country with a lot of trauma, a lot of things that we were trying to work through, and that's showing up. So just want to mention that as like part of that. I know there's a new conversation being had, and I think we get to then define that and address that differently, hopefully, if we engage around foster care. This is an Asian American issue, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. And just like a couple of things, you know, Don, you spoke to a lot of things as a non-Indigenous person. You know, there's a lot that I can't speak to, but, you know, what I can speak to are certain specifics about foster care and how it relates to the Indigenous community. But for more information on that, you know, just want to plug Blood Memory, a documentary done by Sandy Whitehawk, really speaks to that experience of boarding schools and how there was literally a practice of, you know, taking children literally on the street, that when social workers would drive by, you know, they were taught to run inside. Otherwise, they would just literally get snatched up. And that was an extension of this belief that if you educate the child, you destroy the Indian. It is genocide. It was meant to break families in order to destroy Native American culture. Genocide has not necessarily ended. It just changed.
The fact that you mentioned Blood Memory, you just kind of blew my world. So the other thing that Sandy Whitehawk was a part of, which was the Maine reconciliation effort, in which there's also a separate documentary on that. So Sandy, I know, you know, because Sandy was one of these children who was just removed from her family and totally disconnected. And so Blood Memory is her story of that journey back, not only to find out who her family was, but who she was as a Native American. I mean, it's one of the most powerful things to ever see. And then also what she has done for the American Indian community to return individuals back to the community. I mean, so there, you know, there's just so much in that one documentary, and it's so powerful.
I watched that film Blood Memory twice, and I completely agree with you, Don. And it was painful for me to watch and to listen to the trauma that our Native youth and families for generations have faced.
You know, anyone who's done, you know, work with Tulu Resources knows is that it's not a magic trick. It takes real hard work. It takes funding. And that's something that fosters, while we know how to deal with scarcity, you know, Minnesota has so much. This doesn't have to be this way. And we can do it differently. And the people who know that best are fosters, who quite literally carry the scars of the system. And so we know it best. And so really, I just try to get out of the way of the genius of young people who know what needs to be different. The things I'm saying now were the same things I was saying when I was 18. And the only difference is that people hear me now. I learned how to get people to listen, or rather I learned how to get into the room and then I shouted at them. I tried to do that less. It's not super effective. But what I would just say is that, you know, I started this work because I thought people just didn't give a shit. But I'm glad to be wrong. People just don't know. And so it's my job to make sure that they understand, because if you know better, then the hope is that you'll do better. And so now that all of you know, and all the listeners, like, I expect you to do better as well.
Juan, thank you so much for your insight. You've given us so many kernels of wisdom and startling statistics and startling observations. Thank you for everything that you do on behalf of our communities, our families who are in the most vulnerable place. How much more vulnerable can you be than to be a child that has been separated from their family, their biological family, and placed in a system that is foreign to you more often than not, racially and ethnically as well. That's a really big disruption in a child's life that is unforgettable, right? And you can't erase those memories. And then it's followed by a cascade of barriers that you've identified as well as Don, this segment. We're signing off. I'm Luz Maria Frias, Deputy Attorney General with the State of Minnesota. Any comments and opinions that I express are strictly my own and should not be attributed to my employer.
I'm Don Eubanks, Associate of Dendros Group and member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians.
I'm Holly Lee, owner of the Other Media Group and producer of Counter Stories.
Our special guest?
I'm Fong Murphy, and I'm still leading foster advocates as of the end of this podcast.
And we're so grateful that you are. Thank you for joining us. This has been Counter Stories, a co-production of the Counter Stories crew, the Other Media Group, and AMPRS, Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For a full conversation, please visit counterstories.com.